Hello, welcome to the Law Report. It's widely recognised that our criminal justice system deals poorly with sexual assault. Well, in New Zealand, they've come up with a complaint-driven system that can work either alongside or even instead of a criminal trial. New Zealand's Project Restore, that's later. First, making a will. Most of us imagine a very formal, lengthy written document, printed out on paper and then signed by a number of witnesses. But a court decision in Queensland has ruled that a will can also be written on a smartphone. Charlie Young is a senior associate at Brisbane law firm Bennett & Philp. He explains who wrote the smartphone will.
He was a young gentleman in his 20s, originally from Taiwan, had been living in Australia for a number of years, and at the time of his death he was working full-time down in Canberra.
His assets, were they here in Australia or were they back in Taiwan?
They were here in Australia and in Queensland, which is why we approached the Supreme Court of Queensland for orders for probate. The primary asset of the estate here was an apartment located in Queensland, so the assets weren't insignificant.
Tell me about the circumstances of his death.
He was suffering from what I suppose you could call a personal crisis and took the very tragic decision of taking his own life shortly after that crisis arose.
His brother came to you because he wanted to uphold a very unusual will. Tell me about that will.
That's right. When his brother's body was located, the police discovered a smartphone in his possession, and on that phone was what could only be described as his will. It was essentially written out as any normal will would have been, but in a notes application on the smartphone, and rather than it having been signed, he had typed his name in that area, but apart from that, read exactly as a normal will would read. His brother was nominated as the executor under that will, but with there being strict legal requirements as to how a will is to be created, they're left a question as to whether this mobile phone will was valid.
What are the conditions that you have to establish for a will to be valid?
Generally speaking, a will must be in writing and witnessed by two people in order for it to be valid. But the court can do away with those formal requirements if it's satisfied that there is a document, and that can have a pretty wide definition in itself. It can be anything on which writing can be recorded, or it can be a computer from which images or writings can be produced. So you first of all need to establish there is a document. Secondly, you have to satisfy the court that the document set out the person's testamentary wishes, that is, how that person intended their assets to be dealt with upon their death. And thirdly, you need to satisfy the court that the person actually intended that document to be their last will.
And so you went to the Supreme Court of Queensland on behalf of the brother of the deceased. What was the reasoning of the court in upholding the will?
In this situation, the court was satisfied that there was a document. The will written in the notes application was constituted to be a document, even though it wasn't a smartphone. As to the testamentary wishes, the will dealt with most, if not all, of the deceased's assets, and the court was satisfied of that. And just prior to the person having tapped out this will on the smartphone, the person had left a number of farewell notes to family members. And in this particular situation, the court was satisfied that the person was of testamentary capacity at the time this particular will was created. And in light of the farewell letters to the family, showed a well-reasoned survey of the person's assets and how he wanted those assets to be distributed.
Now, is this the first time in Australia, or indeed in the world that we know of, where this format of will has been upheld by a court?
I believe it's the first time such a decision's been made in Australia with respect to a smartphone. As far as overseas, I couldn't quite say, but I'm not aware of any other decision in these circumstances.
And I believe that this document and the others were written when the deceased was in a hotel room. Was that an important fact?
It was important because it assisted the applicant in demonstrating the court as to the validity of the document. And by that, I mean that a coronial investigation report was part of the evidence. And that report demonstrated that there had been no access to the particular hotel room between the time in which the will was created, according to the timestamp on the mobile phone, and the time at which the deceased's body was located. The electronic room key that he used to enter the room recorded the times in which the room had been accessed, and the court was satisfied that there had been no opportunity for anyone to alter the will between the time it was created and the time the police discovered him.
Extraordinary. So this electronic footprint, the swipe card, the iPhone, really helps us know exactly when it was created and gives powerful evidence that this actually was written by the deceased.
That's right. It was certainly helpful in this particular instance. And look, I dare say without that evidence, the court certainly would have had questions as to the authenticity of the document.
Have there been other unusual electronic documents which have been upheld as wills?
There has been a few odd cases around Australia and overseas. One of the better known cases in Australia related to a will which a person had saved on their laptop computer down in New South Wales. And in that particular instance, the Supreme Court of New South Wales granted probate for that will. There's also been a recent case down in Victoria where a person recorded their will on a webcam shortly before they took their own life. And again, in that particular instance, the court granted probate for that particular will. In addition to that, I've heard of a case overseas in the United States where a person had handwritten their will using a stylus on a tablet computer, and again, that will was held to be valid. So with the invent of new technologies, these types of instances are appearing more and more often.
Estate litigation lawyer Charlie Young from Brisbane law firm Bennett and Philp. And if you're experiencing any suicidal thoughts, call Lifeline's 24-hour crisis phone line on 131114. That's 131114. Support and help are just a phone call away. You're listening to The Law Report on RN. Now, perhaps you're listening to a podcast or audio on demand. Both are available from the RN website at abc.net.au/radionational. And if you want to know what's coming up on the program, let's connect on Twitter. The show's handle is at LawReportRN. My personal handle is at Damien_Carrick. Now to New Zealand. For many years, the country has been a world leader in what's known as restorative justice. It usually consists of meetings between a victim and offender in the presence of a trained mediator. Victims take an active role in the process. They get to voice the impact of the crime and what they need to move forward. And offenders are encouraged to take responsibility for their actions, to repair the harm they've done, perhaps by apologising or returning stolen money or doing community service or undergoing counselling. In New Zealand, Project Restore uses restorative justice principles to deal with sexual assault cases. The program's director is Fiona Landon, and Jennifer Annan is a program counsellor who focuses on the needs of survivors. Jennifer says in New Zealand, only about 1% of sexual assault complaints reported to police ultimately result in a conviction. So the system really doesn't meet the needs of complainants.
On a general basis, it doesn't at all. It's based on the British legal system, which is an adversarial system that creates a pitting of one person against the other, and for sexual violence cases very often it is his word against her. When it comes to trial, unless the offender pleads guilty, which is always nice for the survivor if they do, but generally they don't, and there's a very high dropout rate from the time they come in to report, and a high bar that they have to cross before the police will take it to prosecution stage.
A high evidential bar. And what happens if they get to that bar and it actually does go on to prosecution?
So as they move through the court process, it's a very lengthy process. There's a lot of waiting time, a lot of time of anxiety for them, waiting to see if the person's going to plead guilty, and if they don't, then there's even longer waiting time waiting to go to trial. And if it goes to trial, then they're the ones that having to get onto the witness stand and tell their story and have all of the details put out there, usually in front of the jury, and be cross-examined by the defence counsel, which is an incredibly harrowing experience. And often, as they go through it, they're feeling completely re-victimised and re-traumatised all over again.
Fiona, if I can bring you in here, tell me about an alternative which has been established quite successfully in New Zealand. It's called Project Restore. What is Project Restore?
We're an organisation that came about as a result of a call from survivors, really, looking for different ways of experiencing justice, coming out of a criminal justice system that they didn't experience a sense of justice. So we're kind of unique in that we've been driven by survivors and survivors wanting the process.
What does Project Restore do? How does it work?
What we provide is a specialist service for restorative justice and sexual violence. So we will receive referrals from a range of sources, some those that have reported to the police and some where there's been no reporting. And we sit down and talk with the person who contacts us and ask them what they're wanting to achieve in terms of accessing a sense of justice. And then we tailor what we provide to meet what they're wanting to get out of it.
So it's about the offender and the survivor going through a process as an alternative to the courts?
It can be an alternative or it can be alongside the criminal justice system. So where charges have been laid and an offender has pled guilty, then they can access a restorative justice process between the guilty plea and their sentence. They can access restorative justice after they've been sentenced, before they're released from prison, or after they've been released from prison. And sometimes we get referrals from the police where they have done an interview, decided that they don't have enough evidence to charge, but still see that there would be some use in the survivor and the offender talking about what happened. And so they might refer a case to us. We call those pre-charge cases. And often they're the more date rape type of scenarios, young people.
There's also a group of women and men who come into the police at that early stage saying that they want to talk about what happened, but they actually don't want to lay charges. They want an alternative. And so then the police are starting to talk with us more and building relationship with us in terms of passing that referral over to us to pick up.
And what percentage of Project Restore's client base involve people who haven't been through the court system, and what percentage involve, say, a plea of guilty but pre-sentence?
It's about 50% of our referrals are community referrals and 50% are through the criminal justice system.
Can you tell me the kinds of survivors and the kinds of cases that have gone through the Project Restore process? You mentioned before date rapes. Tell me about the range of cases which have gone through this process.
So we've had a full range of cases from the date rape type scenario to a lot of childhood sexual abuse survivors. When they've been through a healing process, they get to a point where they've grown up, this happened to them when they were children, and they're ready to deal with the person that's offended against them. And very often that happens once they've become adults, had children of their own, and particularly as their children are getting to the age that they were offended against. So a lot of our cases have been in that realm.
And a lot of those date rape scenarios where consent, the idea of consent is different for both parties. So the survivor is quite clear that she didn't consent, but the young male in this situation believes that he had consent. And there's not enough evidence to go to a trial, or the survivor doesn't want to go through a trial process. But she does wants to talk to the person and say, actually, wasn't okay, I didn't want that, and you didn't listen to me, you know, that sort of thing.
And there's different options as we tailor make the process. So for a case where that might be the situation, at times we've done what we would call shuttle mediation, in terms of shuttling messages and letters from one to the other until they feel that they've satisfied their questions, had their questions asked and answered.
So you're saying that sometimes it can be, you know, just through correspondence, but sometimes it's about the offender and the survivor sitting in the room together and facing each other and trying to come to some kind of shared acknowledgement of what took place.
Yes, and that's most often the process that we end up with.
What sorts of outcomes do you get?
So with the community referrals, which is one of my passions in terms of survivors having their needs met, because 90% of survivors don't actually report to the police. So there's a huge number of people that are sitting out there with having had experiences of childhood sexual abuse. And it sits in the family as the white elephant, the thing that's very hard for people to talk about within families and to resolve. And also the offender sits with that burden as well, because they've kept it secret and silent for so long. So going through this process enables that to be brought out and to be talked about. So a huge benefit. And we had one survivor fairly early on, as we were doing community referral, talk to us about how it felt like she was taking an emotional holiday as she came into the process. And they had a family meeting to start with. The offender agreed to go into treatment. And as time goes by with these kind of cases, it may be that we come back for a second meeting, which is more the restorative justice process, where the offender can talk about what he was thinking about at the time and have a clearer idea of why he did what he did, which often helps to answer those questions that the survivors have about, well, why did you do it?
And that shared responsibility of keeping everyone else safe, because often survivors feel like they're the one trying to keep everybody safe in the family or the upcoming grandchildren and children, and they're constantly worrying that if something isn't done that the offender's going to offend again. So having the whole family take responsibility for ensuring that no children are put at risk is that part of that emotional holiday that that survivor was talking about. It's like, I don't have to carry this all on my own anymore. It's now shared.
It's very interesting you say that, because of course it's about risk reduction into the future, isn't it? And also it's about families coming together. So it's not just about the survivor and the perpetrator.
And very often there's more than one victim of any particular perpetrator. And this process can help that to come out and help the wider survivor group to do their healing.
Of course, you've been talking about scenarios where interfamily abuse or crime. The information and the conversations that form part of this process, where people sit down together and talk about what happened, frankly, can it be used in any subsequent prosecution or even in any subsequent civil action?
As yet, it hasn't, but that's always an issue. An issue for offenders in terms of the level of responsibility that they take and admissions that they make because of that risk. And that impacts on what we're trying to have as an open and honest conversation, obviously. So that goes against that. And where we've come to in our legal advice has been that there is some protection for the work that we do under the basis that it's a therapeutic intervention and therefore can't be used as evidence, because it wasn't the intended purpose. But that's never been tested in the court, so we have no guarantee that that was the case. And I think it's a double-edged sword, because if offenders are given total protection around what they say, if the survivor is then unhappy with the level of responsibility that they've taken and dissatisfied with the outcome, and then wishes to go on and pursue a court process, then that's kind of denied them that opportunity to do that. So it's a difficult one, which we haven't really found an answer to.
And I find when I'm working with survivors and they're putting forward their wish to meet, they're often saying, well, I actually don't want him to go to jail. I want him to be accountable and to acknowledge and admit what he's done. And it's when for the perpetrator to weigh that up, and this is one of the sucky parts of the criminal justice system, is that they do have a greater chance of getting off if they plead not guilty. And of course, going into that process, they're often given legal advice to say nothing, which kind of goes in quite opposite direction to what we're doing of openness and honesty and transparency. So there's a lot of delicate work that's done with the perpetrator as we're inviting them into the process.
Can I ask, how many conferences have there been under Project Restore?
About 40 over 7 years. The demand for what we do is much greater than our ability to deliver the service. And so we haven't gone out there shouting from the rooftops about what we do, because we wanted to make sure that if people came to us that we could offer them a service and not disappoint them. So we've grown quite slowly, but we've noticed that as the word gets around and as the police and the Crown prosecutors and the criminal justice advocates in the system see our work and see the strengths and the benefits for everybody, then more and more inquiries and referrals have come. And only recently has the Ministry of Justice decided to fund the delivery of sexual violence for restorative justice nationally. So that's the first proper contract for that is about to start next year.
It's currently an Auckland-based service, but the decision has been made this is of value and it's going to be rolled out nationally early next year.
Yes, that's right. And the current contract that the Ministry of Justice rolling out is only for pre-sentence cases at this stage. So they're still trying to work out how they can fund community referrals. But we currently have no contract to deliver referrals outside of the criminal justice system.
And those referrals that come from the community is the referrals where agencies like Auckland Sexual Abuse Help, where I work, are very passionate about having in place. So we continue advocating for getting funding to cover those cases. As I said earlier, 90% of people don't report, so to be able to provide a service to those survivors who don't want to go through the criminal justice system for all the reasons that make it very difficult, to have that option there is critical for them.
Can I ask if it was a question of a pre-sentence scenario, would conclusions about what took place and about how best to move forward be shown to a judge?
Yes, so we write a report to the court, and that report is almost a verbatim of what's spoken in the conference. And the reason why that is because victims don't get a voice in the criminal justice system unless they've been questioned in a trial. Their views don't get elicited and their thoughts and feelings aren't asked about. So this is one of the few ways that their voice can actually be heard. Of course, another way of being heard is through writing a victim impact statement and reading that out in court. But it's a very artificial and formal setting, and there's lots of kind of rules around how and what you can say in a victim impact report. Whereas in the conference, your actual words and your thoughts and feelings and your emotional responses are recorded and then are made available to the judge, along with any agreements that have been agreed to as part of the restorative justice process. We call them outcomes, any agreements that are reached.
What percentage of people who come to Project Restore make it all the way through to a successful outcome? Because I'm imagining that there could be an acknowledgement by an offender that something took place, but there's still a very big gulf between their understanding of what took place and that of the victim. What percentage go all the way through to a successful outcome?
So from inquiry to us meeting and sitting down with them and working out what they want, it's about 10% fall over at that point. And those are usually the court-referred cases where the victim has gone through the criminal justice system, is now waiting for sentencing, and then restorative justice is raised. And it's probably the time that they're least interested, because they're usually quite angry by the time they've got to all the way through to that point. And especially if they've been through a trial to get there. The criminal justice system, you can be processed in the criminal justice system for 9 months before you even get to find out whether they're pleading guilty. So, you know, you could have been waiting for a long time to hear that guilty plea already. So victims aren't always in the right space to do restorative justice then. And then it just depends on what they're wanting. If they're just wanting the judge to hear their views and they want the person to agree to treatment and that's it, then that's fairly simple. But even if it's a situation where they want to have a conversation and they invite the person into the conversation and then they say, no, we're not going to talk about this, then sometimes that's an outcome that then helps the survivor then think, well, actually, no, that's not okay, and now I'm going to go and report. So we consider that a positive outcome. It may be that they want to discuss who attends birthdays and Christmases and they want the family to just know that this person is, you know, a risk to the children and the family, and some agreement around access to children. And that might be all the outcome that they want. So there's a range of things that people might want. Nearly every survivor says, I don't want this to happen to somebody else, and I want to make sure that this person is going to do something that ensures that this doesn't happen to somebody else. So nearly all our offenders have to agree to be assessed for treatment and enter into a treatment program if they've found that they need one and there's one available.
Is there a danger that this can become a soft option, and rather than all of us taking responsibility, that this is an easy way out?
I think nearly every offender, if you asked any of the offenders that had been through our process whether they thought it was a soft option, they would say no, that it's probably the hardest thing they've ever done in their life. It's very confronting, sitting in front of the person that you know you've harmed and hearing about how your behaviour has harmed them and all the implications and the ripple effects going out into all the people that you love and care about in your world, and the shame and remorse that offenders get to express and share as part of this process is a healing experience for them, but it's a painful experience. It's not easy. In terms of sentence, what happens is any expressions of remorse or taking of responsibility is considered to be a factor that goes in offenders' favour in the sentencing. So what we find is that most of the sentences that occur as a result of our work are more tailored to sentences that the survivors are happy and content with. I don't think we've had a single survivor that's regretted the level of consequence in the courts as a result of their participation in the restorative justice process. People still go to jail. There's still an element of punishment in their sentence. They still get the public exposure and all of the sorts of things that a criminal justice system does in terms of putting sexual violence out there. But what we offer is so much more on top of that, and things that are much more helpful and useful to survivors than the criminal justice system offers on its own.
Tell me, this New Zealand program, is there anything similar around the world in terms of its scale and where it sits with the justice system?
No, there isn't. There is a victim mediation program in Scandinavia, which is mostly a shuttle mediation type process of exchanging letters. There's victim and offender mediation programs in the United States and Canada, which are post-sentence, pre-release programs. There was a date rape program in Arizona run by Dr. Mary Koss for a period of time as a pilot, which was a kind of diversionary restorative justice panel process. And there are restorative justice providers around the world that are doing little bits and pieces of sexual violence cases amongst other general restorative justice cases, and kind of testing the water and sort of walking tentatively. There's been a program, I think, in Adelaide around youth and sex offending that was studied quite some years ago, maybe 10 years ago, and a little bit of stuff done in care and protection in terms of bringing whanau family in to create safety plans and things for children, but nothing in the way that we're doing it into that range of cases and range of processes that we're offering.
Fiona Landon and Jennifer Annan, thank you very much for speaking to the Law Reporter, a very important and very interesting discussion.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yes.
Jennifer Annan, Justice Services Counsellor at Project Restore, and Fiona Landon, Project Restore's Program Director. Later this week, Fiona will be in Victoria as a guest of the AIJA, the Australasian Institute of Judicial Administration. She'll be speaking to the state's legal community about Project Restore. That's the Law Report for this week. Thanks to producer Erica Vowles and audio engineer this week, John Jacobs. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks for your company.